Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And I still felt guilty, so I used and used and used. And very quickly, I ran out of money. I sold my car. I'd been on the sick for work. 6 months, they'd stopped paying me. So it was back to thieving. I had no possessions. I'd stolen off my family, stolen off my children. I'd taken money that wasn't mine. So I'm back in full-blown addiction after having been clean for 10 years. And I'm worse than I've ever been.
Welcome to Stand Up, Speak Up, a podcast hosted by Carla Stevens Tolstoy, bringing a voice to complex, underrepresented issues with a host who is driven by her ability to help others. Stand Up, Speak Up provides a rare look into Carla's empathetic process of connecting with people who are navigating all types of profound life challenges. In the first part of this two-part podcast series, interviewing Frank, an addict who has abused drugs from the age of 12, he told us the origins of his addiction and how sniffing glue as a child turned into full-on heroin addiction as an adult. By his own admission, Frank has done some terrible things, including using his child's stroller to steal from shops so he could fund his addiction. Along the way, he has survived attacks from gangs of drug dealers, a punctured lung, septicemia, stab wounds, and a knee infection that left him wheeling around scoring drugs in a wheelchair. Time and time again, the need to satisfy his addiction was always powerful enough for him to overcome any illness.
How do you stay so strong? I know that it's hard for you day to day, but I feel just talking with you and going through the site that you've created, I mean, I feel like you still have like quite a bit of hope, and you're working towards solving all this, but God, it must feel so overwhelming. I mean, you just telling me your story, I'm like, oh gosh, like, you know, like it's hard not to think of just jumping in front of a train. I know that sounds so
I hear you. Yeah, I do. Because I guess, I know that I'm more than my addiction. I know that when I'm not using and I'm not addicted, I am very loyal, very honest, the best friend. So, and I've seen that side of me. You know, I had a long period of sobriety. That's what I want back. I've had a taste of that. So that gives me hope because I've done it before. But more importantly, I was on death's door when I went to my sister's in Sweden. That's not an exaggeration. I was close to death. A couple more months of my lifestyle and I would have died. And I'm alive. And I'm clean. And I get to sleep every night without using heroin. You know, I don't need to. I get up in the morning. My first thought isn't, oh, God, how am I going to get a score? Who am I going to rip off? Who am I going to rob? Have I got anything to sell? What can I pawn? I get up and I make a coffee. The difference in lifestyle is amazing. So the hope that I have is, I guess, I wouldn't even call it hope. It's determination. I don't want to exist. I want to live. And my life previously, when I've been using, has just been an existence. It's been horrible. It's horrific. You know, I've really just scratched the surface. But I've achieved stuff in my life. And I don't mean financially. I just mean in terms of just being a productive person, you know, being an honest person, being what you would class as a normal person if they exist. I mean, I don't know. But that's what I'm aiming for. I'm aiming to get that life back. And I have started. You know, that's where I'm at now. And I smile.
What are some of the memories of things that you experienced or did that still haunt you, that still create a lot of anxiety in when you think about it? What do you consider as the...
Now, I have no relationship with any of my children, okay, as a result of using, which causes me a lot of anxiety. Slowly started to build a relationship with my youngest son.
And do you think it's possible to reconcile with your kids and to get their forgiveness?
That's a big question, and that's, I guess, something that's personal for them. So as it stands at the moment, I have limited contact with my youngest, which is by means of messaging. My other older two that aren't biologically mine, but as I say, I've been there all their life, they're not in contact with me at the moment. But I still continue to send the odd message to them. You know, I reach out to them. If it's a birthday, I'll remember to send a card. But they've been through this before with me when I come out of rehab last time that my sister paid for. And I'd relapsed within a week, and I'd been 3 months clean then, admittedly in rehab. So for them, I think it's going to take a long time. I don't think they're angry with me. Of course they are. I deserted them, you know. How long will it take? I don't know. As long as it takes. But I do have a belief that it'll be okay, just as long as I stay well. And I think it will be.
What do you want to apologize to each of them for? Like, if there's something that you feel you've done to each of them independently.
Well, I guess for the oldest, it would be to apologize for having walked out and left him to then take up father's role and to look after a broken family. He had to step up to the plate because I deserted them. I don't think that helped him physically or mentally or with his health. He was also looking after his mum at that time because she was drinking as a result of everything that I put her through, you know, and the fact that she's an alcoholic anyway. So he had to step up to the plate, really. So I would apologise for stealing part of his childhood. I mean, he was a young man, you know, 21, 22, but he shouldn't be dealing with that at that age. So his life was turned upside down. To my middle one, I was his best mate. We were very close. I would apologise to him for deserting him and leaving him. excuse me. For my youngest son, I walked out on him when he was doing his exams, most important period of his life. He's very intelligent. He did very well at school. But I believe he could have done a lot better had he had not been going through the trauma that he was going through. With me having walked out and him living on his own at this point then with his mum who was drinking. So my addiction and my walking out has left a broken family and it's broken. And that's what I would apologise for because I stole everything that they had. And I don't mean material things. I mean, I stole their family from them through my actions. You know, we were a normal 2.4 children, you know, a normal functioning family. You know, one of my sons is he's got his own business. He's a qualified plumber. Another son's got his own business in IT. My youngest son, he's going to go to university. They're good lads. They're clever lads. But this is going to have scarred them. There's a lot of stuff that I need to apologise to them for, and I couldn't do it all here and now.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a start. And then what about to your other kids?
Well, my daughter, that's a completely different kettle of fish. I'm in the process of trying to write a letter to her at the moment, which I've wrote a number of times and ripped it up because I don't quite know where to start. But I know that I'm the dad and it's my responsibility. She's a child, so it's for me to try and put right. So if I was going to apologise to my daughter, that would be really, I guess, my apology to my daughter would be for abandoning her when she was a child, for allowing her to be adopted. And whilst we had contact throughout, she was still always adopted. She never come and live with me and my partner and my children. I would apologise that she felt left out, that she felt abandoned, that she felt that I picked children that were not mine, that were not biologically mine over her, which wasn't the case. But I'm sure if I was her, that's how I would feel. And to my son, who I've never seen, my apology to him would be, I'm sorry that I don't know you. I'm sorry we didn't get the chance to get to know each other. I'm sorry that, you know, you were moved along before I ever got to see you or know you or have a relationship with you, because I've never met him. I've never seen him.
I mean, that's a lot of stuff to carry with you.
Yeah, it is. It is. And there's a lot of stuff that I've generated myself as well through the lifestyle that I had and the things that I've done in order to survive. I've got a lot of baggage. Yeah, there is. There's an awful lot of baggage. But I also believe very strongly. Sorry, go on.
No, I just think if I had seen you on the streets, would I have felt that you could have gotten from beyond that? Do you know what I mean? Like,
no.
You're, the way you've painted your life, I just think, wow, like, how did you make it past that when so many others don't? Like, something's on your side.
Yeah, that's my sister, partly. She never gave up. She knew that I was dying. She knew that I'd given up. She knew that as a result of losing my family, when I say family, I mean my partner and my children, she knew I'd given up on myself. I was passively committing suicide. So one thing that I'm grateful for is she never gave up. She was always there, even when I didn't want her to be, and I'd ignore her calls, you know, and I wouldn't talk to her. But she paid for me to go into rehab, and I come out and relapsed. And like I explained, I was worse this time, and that's why she agreed to let me go to a house to detox, which is massive, because I've stolen off her loads of times. You know, I've robbed a house in the past. It was a massive risk that she was taking.
Often it takes not only one person who cares, but a group to come together and help someone who was on a path to self-destruction. A standout individual in Frank's group was his sister, who never gave up on him and always did what she could to drag him from the quagmire. Frank's relapse after 10 years of sobriety was no exception, and she gathered all her resources to bring back the man she had seen flourish outside of the grip of addiction.
She must be just an amazing person. I mean, she went into a discipline where she takes care of others, right?
And I've done a lot of bad stuff to my sister that I've not touched on, you know, just because we'd be here for 50 hours or so. But she's never given up. She's never given up. And she knew that I was dying. I mean, the hospital admissions, you know, they were getting serious. I was very malnutritioned. I was, you know, 9 stone. My proper weight's 14 stone. I wasn't eating. I've got emphysema, you know, lung condition. I've got a DVT. I've got a hole in one of my lungs. And then not eating and then using the amount of drugs that I was using. She knew that I was going to die. And I knew that. I'd resign myself to that. In many respects, it would have been a relief. I didn't have the courage to commit suicide, and nor would I. Nor would I, because it's just not the sort of person that I am. But I knew that that's exactly what was happening. I knew that I was dying. And I'd be dead if it weren't for my sister. So that's how I got through it, is my family, my sister. She didn't give up on me. And not just my sister, you know, my younger brother too, you know. He's done so much for me too. In fact, all of my family have in different ways. You know, my brother in the States, he paid a quarter towards my rehab fees when I went into rehab, you know, 18 months ago. Because they've all seen a massive change. You know, they've seen Frank the addict, the messed up kid, the person in and out of jail, always in trouble, to them becoming someone who had a career, you know, responsible, children, family, to going right back to who he was before, but so much worse. My family identified that, saw how serious it was. And my sister knows me very well, even though we don't speak. She knew I'd given up on myself. I was waiting to die because addiction is hell. And, you know, I didn't have the strength to stop at that time. I couldn't get out of it. I didn't want to stop using, if I'm honest with you, at that time. I couldn't see any way out. So it's my sister who I have a lot of gratitude for. And also family and friends as well, because my life was that unmanageable. I couldn't even get my shit together to go and get a photograph for a passport. You know, I was given the money for that. I spent it. People had to come and physically pick me up and drive me to locations. and make sure that they brought money with drugs to in order so I could score before I would go and do what they wanted me to do, because I was beholden to drugs. You know, I couldn't function without having used. So, and my sister, you know, she financed a lot of this, you know, and she would never enable me. She'd never buy me drugs. But she realised there's no way I would get over to Sweden on the plane without having it used.
Yeah, well, you'd be detoxing on the plane, and that would be horrible for everybody involved. And could get you kicked off.
Yeah, I wouldn't have even gone. She arranged it in such a way that she paid for a hotel the night before I was due to fly over to Sweden, because I'd just been released from police custody for a burglary. Because I thought I was going to get sent to jail, but I got bail. She paid for a hotel. She gave me a couple of hundred quid to score the next day, so I could have enough drugs for the drive down to the airport and then to use before I got on the plane. Because if I'd have woke up that day without that money, I wouldn't have been coming to Sweden. I'd have been out looking to earn some money, because, you know, I was in active addiction, and that's what addicts do. They use.
Do you think it's different this time?
Yeah, I know it is.
Why this time is it different?
My brother asked me this question, strangely enough. And as you can probably imagine, I've spouted lots of stuff over the past about why it's different this time. And I've actually meant what I've felt. But it's different this time because I'm different. And it sounds very corny, but that's the truth. I'm different. I actually feel free. I remember a moment when I felt free. It's on my website, you know, on MichaelTurkeyDetox.com. I was stood in the kitchen making a cup of tea, and I had a feeling of serenity. First time I felt that in a very long time. And it wasn't a thought, it was a feeling. I felt it in my stomach. I felt it in my chest. And it was one of relief. It was like I finally realized I'm not addicted to heroin and crack. I'm actually free. And it was I don't know if I'd go as far as saying it was spiritual. I'm not a very spiritual or religious person, if I'm honest with you. But it was something that I've not had happen to me before. So I guess I grabbed onto that with two hands, the realization that I'd finally done it and I was free. And I felt calm and I felt good. And that's it, really. My attitude's different. I want different things for myself. And I know how lucky I am to be alive. And I know I don't have another relapse in me. If I relapse, I'll die. I'm under no illusions. That's, you know, the white and black of it is that when I use really hardcore. There are no boundaries. It's manic using. It's out of all proportion. But that's not enough to stop me using. Consequences, because if that was the case, having gone to jail and having gone through what I'd gone through would have stopped me using. It's different because I feel different. And I had my first example of that the other day. You know, I had to hand myself into the police. I was wanted for a number of offences through the lifestyle that I was living before I got clean. I left the country while I was on bail at two different courts. So I had to go to court the other day with the very real possibility of going to jail. And that's living life on life's terms, you know, and that's a consequence for my actions. But I went there positive, not positive because of what I'd done, but positive because I was clean. And I handed myself in, you know, and I didn't go to jail. I'm sat here talking to you on the phone now. So it's about living life on life's terms, because life can be shit sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, that's for sure. And I think that you've seen a lifetime of shit, to be honest.
Yeah, there's been a lot of shit. There has. There's been a lot of shit. But then I guess everybody goes through some sort of shit in different varying levels. So it's more about the future now. Frank's looking forward to the future. I'm not looking in the past. I'm trying to drag one foot forward after the other. I'm trying not to let my past define me. I could sit and get really depressed about how hard it's going to be for me to get a job with my criminal record, and, you know, it's going to be impossible to earn a living, and how am I going to fill my time with work? But I don't allow myself to feel or think like that. I remember what I need to be grateful for, and that's because I'm breathing, because that's the reality of it. I'm alive. And I don't think I would be now if I hadn't have gone to Sweden. And to be honest with you, my past, I mean, yeah, there's been a lot of shit, but I'm okay with it. I'm okay with it. It's what's happened. Can't change your past. There's nothing that I can do about it. And this will sound really corny, but I've forgiven myself because until I did that, that was a massive problem because guilt is a massive relapse potential, and I've relapsed on guilt a number of times.
Guilt and shame, it's like our own worst enemy.
Yeah, yeah. So I had to forgive myself, which is sounds really ironic, really, because I should be asking for other people's forgiveness, but that's what's working for me at the moment.
We wanted to take a moment to tell you about how you can support what is being accomplished on the Stand Up Speak Up podcast. Please leave a review on this platform. And of course, we're always open to suggestions and ideas for guests. We're always listening on Facebook at Stand Up Speak Up Podcast. Now, back to part two of Frank's story. Frank knows he has a lot to be grateful for, and he knows that he has seriously hurt a lot of people throughout his life. People for whom he should have been the rock that held them together. These people wanted him to be the man they all knew he could be, but he let them down time and time again. He will never be done with his addiction. He will always be in recovery, and the best he can hope for is to manage his addiction and fight the urge to use again.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the cravings never end. Do they ever end? Do you ever stop craving?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, did for me. When I had that long period of being clean for 10 years, I never thought about drugs. It got to the point where, because addiction drugs, are, you know, they're the same thing, but yet they're different as well, because, you know, addiction affects you on many different levels. It doesn't just have to be drug-related, you know, it can be food, gambling, whatever. But I got to the point where I never used to think about using heroin or crack when I had my long period of being clean. It was literally like the monkey had, you know, gone off my shoulder without sounding corny. I never thought about it. You know, I was working. I had a good job. I was being productive. I was free. So, yeah, it does leave you. I mean, and the cravings, as I understand it, they're only when you're going through withdrawal. As in, you know, the cravings to use heroin, it's more after when you're clean. I guess you could call it cravings, but I don't know, is it desire, is it want, you know, because for me personally, I only really craved heroin when I was using heroin, if you know what I mean.
When you were working and you would get stressed or like your day would go really badly, how would you cope?
Really badly, if I'm honest with you. I never used to talk about what was going on at work. I had an agreement with my ex-partner that we didn't discuss work when I got home because it was always stressful. It was quite a stressful environment. So I used to do what I always do, and I just used to block it out. I'm very good at sticking things in boxes and ignoring them, which is a really bad character trait because obviously stuff comes back up after a while. But I just used to bury my head in the sand as regards that. So I didn't used to get stressed. I'm not the sort of person to get stressed, if I'm honest with you. I've got quite a laid-back nature. It takes an awful lot for me to get stressed. But I'm one of them people, when I do get stressed, when I do pop, I pop really bad. So it's kind of like bottling everything down, and then eventually it explodes. But I'm chilled out a lot of the time. I don't get stressed. I'm quite fortunate that way.
Did you ever think of just getting a really simple job, a job that doesn't, that won't get you stressed? Like just.
I did. Yeah, I did. But I couldn't afford to because, you know, I'd bought a house, I had a mortgage, I had children, I had outgoings, and I was earning a good wage. And our lifestyle had become accustomed to the wage that I was earning, you see. So I was trapped. I wanted to start my own business in IT because I'm good with IT. But I never really, I didn't dare take that leap, if you know what I mean, because I had commitments and responsibilities. And when you're starting a business off, you don't make a lot of money in the beginning, you know, and it's not something I could have done part time. So I couldn't really change my job, if I'm honest with you, Carla. I was stuck, or that's how it felt, because I'd been such a bad parent and partner previously before I got well, I felt beholden to continue to make sure that, you know, I was the breadwinner, you know, and it became an obsession almost to make sure that I provided for my family, because it was something that I hadn't done previously. So I got quite obsessive over it, and money became quite a big part of my life, not in terms of wanting to be rich, but just wanting to make sure I could give them what I hadn't given them previously. Guilt, really, I guess, you know. So I didn't move jobs because I didn't feel I could.
Do you think that doing your own business is something you would consider now?
Yeah, it's something that I've started doing. It's something that's going to take a long time. But if I want any, I think, decent standard of living where I earn a half decent wage, I'm going to find getting employed really difficult because of my criminal record, especially because of the relapse, you know, 2 years ago. As you know, I've just been in the court system. So that kind of limits the type of work that I can do. Not every job do criminal records checks, but manual work, they don't. But of course, I've got some health issues. I've got emphysema, so I wouldn't be able to do a full day's manual work. So for me, trying to start off my own business is something that I'm doing, and I'm in the process of doing. And I've also got the website going, you know, that I mentioned previously, with the videos on it and the writings, and I'm trying to commit more time to that, doing more writings and more blog posts. And I don't really know where my what direction my career is going to go in, but I'm going to try and do something, you know, and I've got some ideas, and as I say, we'll see what happens. I won't get my hopes up because it's not easy. but I think working for myself, as long as I stay motivated, as long as I make sure that I put a day's work in, I'm hoping I might be able to make some money somehow, so I can get my own place and not continue stopping at my brother's.
Well, I sent you, you know, the article this week, and I thought maybe we could talk about that. And it was an article of someone that had gone through detoxing heroin and just shared some of their experiences. And I just wanted to know how relevant that was to you. And, you know, I thought maybe we could talk about that, and you could actually talk about the types of things he says, and just say, and say how that also was the same experience for you. The crack. Five unexpected things I learned from being a heroin addict.
So the first thing that I see is addiction isn't instant. That makes it worse. It's that's a little, you take one hit and you're hooked. Well, that's obviously not true. Okay, what does it take to become? I think people don't start off on heroin, not in my experience. It's not something that people choose to do. You know, you don't wake up and think, well, I'm going to be a smackhead or a heroin addict. For me, it's a progression. There's usually other drugs involved first, in my experience. And it's not, you know, one hit and you're addicted. Quite the opposite. You know, when I first used heroin, I used it for quite some time without having any withdrawals, without realising that I was addicted to it. And I enjoyed it, you know. It's not all doom and gloom. Otherwise, there wouldn't be people that are addicted to heroin, because you wouldn't do it more than once if it was horrible. You don't start off on a needle taking heroin. I don't know anybody ever who started taking heroin by injecting it, and I know a lot of people that abuse heroin. It's usually taken, you know, initially by smoking it. The needle bit came for me, in all honesty, when I was ill. I was withdrawing, I had no money, and I was offered a fix, and it was make a decision, you know. This person's not going to share it with me to smoke. They inject it. So either, you know, I have an injection of it, or I continue feeling the way I felt. I made that decision in a split second. You know, that was the hold of heroin addiction for me. The withdrawals, I don't know. It's hard to explain, but it's the fear of the withdrawals as well, not just the withdrawals. And that was, you know, that was how I progressed onto needles. But I smoked it first for quite some time. And after I used it that first time in the needle, that didn't mean, oh, right, okay, I'm going to continue injecting heroin, because I didn't. You know, I continued to smoke it when I could. It was something that I progressed to over time. And that was for a number of different reasons, but mainly it was because heroin is expensive, and you can use less when you inject it initially. And that was the reason behind me, it was more financial than anything. I couldn't afford to keep smoking it. So that's my answer to that, I think. I'm just flicking through the page now.
The next thing they kind of talk about is, you know, the writer is saying everybody gets blackened limb rot and abscesses, and it's not so unique like they say in the movies. It's not such a big deal where they get rushed to the hospital. So what would you say with that?
I would say that's complete and utter, I'm not going to swear, but yeah, that's just not true. I injected, amphetamines for, you know, quite a long time before I started injecting heroin, and I injected heroin for years and years. I didn't get any abscesses. I didn't have any problems whatsoever medically. There were times when I was injecting in my neck because, you know, my veins were that bad. I couldn't get a vein. So I hadn't started injecting in my, in my groin at this period. So I was injecting in my neck and I never got any infections. You know, I didn't get these big black marks that you see in the movies. The only mark that I would get was if I missed the vein and I pushed the substance in. And that's because it wasn't in the vein and obviously you'd end up with a lump. I got my first infection from using drugs actually when I relapsed after my 10 years being clean. And I think that's because I was older as well, when my body doesn't repair as fast, but also because I was using in the same site probably 20, 30 times a day, not giving it time to heal. And that's when I got an infection. So that's something that I worked up to. It's not something that you start off with. I think that's probably scaremongering.
Would you see a lot of people have infections, though? I mean, was it very common to see people with infections that you were doing drugs with?
Just a quick interjection. I'm Zach Tolstoy, one of the founders of Stand Up Speak Up. Our podcast is just one part of the Stand Up Speak Up brand. We are supported by an online store of the same name where we sell a variety of artisan products. We have an ongoing blog series with over a dozen contributors, and we offer a series of interactive workshops. Throughout the different iterations of Stand Up Speak Up, our core message and purpose have always been the same: to create a site that allows our customers and us more opportunities to speak up about and support causes, organizations, and groups that we're passionate about, and that of course could use additional support. My mother and I have learned about allyship over the years from what feels like 1,001 places and people. We want to encourage members of this fantastic Stand Up Speak Up community to come along and learn with us. So along with our team, we created this workshop featuring videos, articles, and exercises that have really helped the two of us in our own journey towards allyship. Don't worry, it doesn't cost any money, and you don't need to make an account to access the information. We want to make our workshop as accessible as possible because we believe in our message and understand the importance of spreading awareness. The Ally Workshop is split into 8 parts, including interactive quizzes and helpful videos. It's intended to introduce you to new skills and courses of action in the world of allyship. The workshop is easy to use and can be done entirely on your cell phone, tablet, or computer at your own pace, with each of the 8 sections taking an average of about 15 minutes or so to complete, or a breezy couple hours on a Sunday afternoon.
Sometimes, you know, I see people with legs amputated occasionally. Sometimes people would have an infection. I remember one guy, it was that bad. You know, he couldn't even get on the bus or the tram because the smell was that bad. People would get off. You know, it was really embarrassing for him. But this wasn't often. This was few and far between. When you get, I don't know about in America, but in the UK, when you use a needle exchange program, you go there, they give you all the equipment. It's all new. You get the alcohol swabs. Assuming that you use them correctly, the risk of getting infection is really low, actually. You know, if you clean the area before you inject with alcohol and you use clean equipment, it's unlikely you're going to get an infection. If you do, it's going to come from the substance.
Did you always go to safe injection sites? Were there enough available for you?
Yeah, what I used to do is one thing I can say that I haven't done is I've never shared equipment. Only because I used to pick up each time 100. So I'd pick up 100 needles, 100 amps of water, 100 swabs, alcohol wipes. And I was quite organised in because I was always in various city centres stealing, the needle exchanges were always in the city centres. So it was quite easy for me. If I'd done something wrong or I'd stole something, I'd usually go to one of the needle centres to get new needles. So I always had clean equipment, is what I'm trying to say. It was something that I kind of make sure. I was using the needle centres to hide away a lot of the time, but also getting needles, and then coming back out half an hour later or so. But now they've put limits on the UK, for some strange reason, you can only get 6, which I think is stupid. In my opinion, it forces people, or it makes it more easier that people are going to share equipment. I don't understand the logic behind that.
Do you believe that the injection sites are of value and that they should continue? And
yeah, definitely, of course, yeah, because otherwise what you're going to have are a lot of addicts with Hep C and Hep B and AIDS and all types of different infections because they can't get their hands on the equipment that they need, and regardless of whether they want to get well or not get well, make it as safe as we possibly can, give them the equipment that they need. Because they're going to do it anyway.
Yeah, okay, that comes to my next question. Knowing that you could get infections and get sick, does that prevent you at all with your addiction? Do those scare tactics work?
No, never. Not once. Not ever. My education on drugs at school was just say no. It was something that they ran in the UK. And it was basically just say no, drugs are bad for you, you'll be addicted and they'll kill you, one hit and you'll be dead. And that was, the education that I had. So I knew that wasn't true. So anything else that I heard from that point onwards, I didn't believe, if I'm honest with you. And the risk of getting infections, and the risk of having a bad hit, so to speak, I didn't even know what a bad hit was until I had one, in all honesty. There is no education in the schools in terms of the real life stuff that goes on with addiction. It's scaremongering. It's trying to, it's not educating people. It's trying to scare people, which is completely different. So for me, I think we should be as open with, people at that addiction, rather than trying to scare them off it, because people are going to do it anyway, so educate people so they can do it safely. And hopefully with the education, they might make the decision not to. But scaremongering doesn't work. It didn't work for me. And it hasn't worked for all the other addicts that I know that are in the UK that have been through the education system. So the fear of getting infections, no, definitely not. It didn't worry me in the slightest. And by this point, when I'm injecting, I wouldn't have cared. Because at that point, I was in active addiction. And there was only one thing that was important, and that was getting a hit and having a fix. So it wouldn't have made any difference either way at that point.
Well, the next point that he kind of talks about is the effects it had on his physical body. And one is that he said when you're in active addiction, your smell isn't the same. Sounds get muffled. Mm. Your body is numb. Yeah. You lose the ability to orgasm. Would you say that's all correct?
Very true. Yeah, very true. For me, I've been in hospital a lot of times. Heroin's done a lot of stuff. My using. I've had infections, blood infections, septicemia. I nearly died from that. I've got emphysema of the lungs. I've got lots of different health things. So they were things that happened to me as a result of using heroin. But in terms of just the normal everyday things, yes, you lose the ability to orgasm. But also, everything is almost fuzzy and hazy. That would be my description of it. So it's almost like you're not paying as much attention to everything. But it's not that. It's that your senses are dumbed down, which is the reason that I was using heroin. I didn't deal with crap that had gone on in my life. I've suppressed a lot of stuff since the age of 12. And as I went through the different drugs, you know, you get to a point where you get a really high tolerance and they don't seem to do what you were using them for. And for me, heroin just shut me down. You know, it just turned me off. So it was a mental thing too for me. It allowed me to not think, which is exactly what I wanted to do. I didn't want to think, but more importantly, it allowed me to not feel. Because for me personally, when I actually used heroin, I didn't really have any emotions at all. I never really experienced, you know, happiness or sadness, or I didn't have, you know, you'd be with your friends and you'd be laughing and it'd be a belly laugh, you know, and you're really having a good laugh. I didn't have anything like that when I was using, because it just switched me off, heroin did. It just turned me into a bit of a zombie, which is why I used it. That's what I wanted from it. I didn't want to be me. So that's why I used it.
When you compare sniffing gasoline and paint thinner, what drug does that compare to as the same feeling?
I've not taken another drug that's made me feel like sniffing glue, if I'm honest with you. Glue is something that is... very hard to describe. I've not taken another drug that I could compare it to. But what I would say about it is I was totally out of control. I had no recognition of what I was doing when I was using glue. And a lot of the time, it would be just for the whole day. And before I would know it, you know, it would be nighttime and I would have been sniffing glue all day. And I would just literally be buzzing all over my body and my head swelling. But it was a nice feeling. I know that sounds strange, but it was. It was better than feeling
And is this frank, just, is this know. Glue that you can get from the school, or like just everyday glue that I would use to fix stuff around the house? Or
no, it's a strong glue. It's it has to be high solvency based. So it was I don't want to mention brands, and I don't even know if you know, but it's the super glue types that you would get in the tub. Yeah, it's the type of stuff that really would stink your house out if you used a bit of it in your house. It's very toxic.
Wouldn't that give you like a horrible headache?
It does at first. Yeah, it does. It does. But it was better than feeling how I felt. It was just it was just a different place to be. I didn't have to be me anymore. You know, I could be somewhere else and switch off.
In the first episode, Frank talked about being attacked by a group of drug dealers to whom he owed money. But the fact that he put himself in that position gives the impression that he no longer cared about himself and just wanted it all to end.
But as you said, was that at the time when you didn't care if you lived?
Yeah, that's exactly where I was. This is where my last relapse took me. It was so much worse because I'd been clean for such a long period of time. And I'd built up, you know, my own home and my family, and then I'd lost everything. And I had all the feelings of guilt of walking out on my family and my children because I was a heroin addict again. I didn't want to feel. So I spiraled out of control. I was using as much drugs as I could every day, heroin and crack together at the same time, which took me to a completely different level as opposed to when I've been using drugs previously. The crack made it so much worse. I found that I was committing crimes that I'd never committed in addiction previously. You know, I wouldn't have considered robbing dealers in the past. I'd have been too scared to. But at this point in my addiction, I didn't care. I didn't want to commit suicide. I didn't want to do that. But I knew that the life I was living, I knew I was going to end up dead, either from malnutrition, not eating and being extremely underweight, or from being killed as a result of drugs in some way, form or another. And my sister knew this too. You know, she spotted this too, and this is why she offered me the chance to detox at her house. And the doctors had said in the hospital, you know, we're giving 6 months. You know, I wasn't in the best physical condition. I've had a lot of hospital admissions. And I think I mentioned previously, I've left a number of times and not completed treatment because I needed to score. You know, I wanted to score. And I didn't want to get well at that period in time. I just wanted to get out of my face. And I had no hope. I didn't see any way back. So I'd resign myself to the fact that I would die at some point. So all my whole day, every day was just focused on getting money, scoring, using, and then starting that process again. And it was a very dark place to be, and I'm really grateful that I made it out. And that sounds dramatic, but it's the reality. I very nearly died on more than one occasion.
Do you consider using Suboxone or methadone to keep the cravings? How do you feel about Suboxone and methadone?
I think that, if I'm honest with you, everybody's different and everybody recovers in a different way. And I don't have all the answers. When I got clean for 10 years, that was using methadone. That was how I managed to get that sobriety. So for me, yes, methadone's really addictive. And the withdrawals are a lot worse than coming off heroin. They last a hell of a lot longer, and it's in your body a lot longer. But it helped me, methadone, to step away from the life of an active addict. So I was able to disassociate with people who were using and dealers, not withdraw, use a heroin, and try and get a normal life. And that was what led me to my career. You know, when I got employed, I was still on methadone, doing an invisible reduction. So personally, for me, it worked. But for other people, it doesn't work. And Suboxone is a drug that I haven't used in detox. But I know a lot of people who have. And I say the same. I say we're all different. You know, everybody recovers differently. Not everybody does it cold turkey. Not everybody goes into rehab. Not everybody can do it on methadone. So I think there's a place for all these different types. I think the problem that we've got is, in the UK, the drug services will just stick you on a methadone prescription. They're overrun. And what happens is, within a year, the drugs worker will try and take you off it, and they'll reduce it too quickly. And I had that happen to me a lot of times. So I'd start withdrawing and get down to a certain amount. So then I'd use, you know, and that was a repeated cycle. So I do think there is a place for them drugs, but I think they're really dangerous. But then being a heroin addict is worse, in my opinion. You know, it's easier to live taking methadone than it is to living the life of an active heroin addict. I think it's a lot more dangerous.
What does it feel to be on methadone and Suboxone from what you've experienced and what you've heard? I mean, how does it work exactly?
So methadone for me, because my addiction before I got clean was really high, I was using very high amounts. I was given a very high amount of methadone. I was given 80 mils, which is quite a lot, if I'm honest. And I was given what's called a maintenance prescription because they tried to take me off it so many times and I'd relapsed. I got a drug worker in the end who agreed, yeah, you're going to be dead, so we'll just let you have the methadone and you tell us when you want it to cut down. And I said, I will. And what that did for me was it just stopped me withdrawing. I got no effects off it at all. I wasn't nodding. I didn't feel high. I didn't, you know, I was driving a car. I was going to work. I was being productive. I didn't get any kind of feelings of being high. And it didn't work like that for me. You know, maybe if I had took loads, a lot more, it might have. But for me, it just allowed me to function, just like a normal person who isn't addicted to a substance who starts withdrawing. All it did is made me feel normal. And when I say normal,
does it give you a better peace of mind? Does it give you calmness? Does it give you better focus?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It suppresses feelings, definitely. So when I was on methadone, because I have an issue with feelings, I don't like them. They frighten me, you know, and they have in the past. So I've used in order not to feel, and methadone does do that for me. It does block out feelings. There is a numbness to it. But like you just, you know, described, there's also a calmness too. So for me, it wasn't a feeling of being high, but there was a disassociation from my feelings. It was like I was able to keep everything bottled down still. And I know this because when I was coming off the methadone, which was done what you would call an invisible reduction, so I was given the same amount, but I didn't realise what strength it was. I started getting quite emotional at times, quite sad. Quite happy, quite extremes, actually, and couldn't understand what was going on because I didn't realise, because it was this invisible reduction, that I wasn't actually taking methadone anymore. So it definitely helped me in one respect, but I didn't deal with anything while I was taking methadone because everything was suppressed.
Well,
so there's the pluses and the minuses.
But what happens when it's not in your system and you're experiencing this range of emotions. How do you cope with that?
In the past, I've never been able to cope with it. When everything has come back flooding all at once, I've not dealt with it, and I've used, because I've got so much suppressed stuff that I've not dealt with. It'd all start coming up to the surface. So my go-to default behaviour would be, oh, I don't like this. I think I'm going to go and get high. Sorry, what was the question, Carla? I'm really sorry.
No, I just think, like, it's just interesting how you said, you know, and I think emotions scare a lot of people. Like, I think that's what drives addiction is, right? Everybody wants to escape. And so how do you teach an addict to be okay with their feelings and embrace different emotions? And
do you know what? That's a really good question. And, you know, when you work out the answer to that, I think you'll become rich.
Yeah.
I really do. I think that's a really good question. I've been in lots of different rehabs, and it's hard, you know, there'll be 12-step programs, there'll be different types, there'll be detox facilities, but it's all centered around addiction and withdrawal. So, you know, getting clean, going through the withdrawals, and then if it's a 12-step treatment facility, you know, working the steps, so to speak. There isn't really any, as far as I can remember, I've done rehab a lot of times, but I've never really been done any workshops or done any work as regards my feelings. I've been in quite a few rehabs. I've never had a one-to-one with a counsellor sat down, you know, and spoke about, you know, the sort of stuff that we're talking about now, about feelings and stuff. I don't know if that's a funding issue. I don't know what it is. So I think that's probably the place where you ought to start trying to teach addicts how to cope with the feelings, as if they're in rehab and stuff. But my experience is that hasn't happened. A lot of them here, I don't know about in America, but their businesses are privatised. They want you in and out, and they want the money, because there's a lot of money in addiction, because there's a lot of us who are unwell.
Well, you know, it just makes me think a little bit, you know, when you were working for that company and they would have given you a good healthcare package, would that have included free therapy? And would you have used that?
No, I wouldn't have, if I'm honest with you. And yes, it did. I could have accessed some services if I wanted to. But while I was working for them, I didn't, I guess, I was, life was good. You know, I was happy. So I do what I usually do. I didn't want to deal with the past. I was able to block that out. I could have accessed therapy, I guess, but I didn't do. And I wouldn't have, if I'm honest with you, because I'm usually a really private person, and I never speak to people about what's going on for me as a person. I can have superficial conversations with people all day long, and I'm really good at supporting other people. But when it comes to me and what's going on for me, I find it really hard to speak. The reason this is easy is because it's anonymous. And it's over the phone. I'd really struggle with this conversation with the therapist. So I don't think I would have accessed it, if I'm honest with you. And I was brought up, you know, by my dad's feelings. You know, blokes don't feel, you know, that's for women. My dad was a big Scottish burly man, brought up, you know, I mean, he's 85, 86 now. So we were taught very early when my mum died not to feel, you know, because my dad couldn't cope with it. So that's something, you know, that I've inherited from him. So I don't think I would have accessed therapy.
This interview with Frank over the last two podcasts has really opened our eyes to the kind of life a person is forced to lead once they become an addict. Turning to drugs or alcohol is a means of escape for so many, and such was the case for Frank. Being encouraged to talk about his feelings from a young age would have helped Frank and so many others like him, creating that safe, open space where people can talk to one another about what they are feeling is so important to all of us. Call it therapy. Call it counseling. Just call it talking to another human being. Just get out there and do it. And don't keep things bottled up. Carla, as somebody who has dealt with people with drug addiction before, whether you spoke to them or them being in your lives, after listening to Frank's story, do you believe he has a chance to get sober again forever?
Oh, that's a loaded question. I think that it's been a few months and Frank is still sober and I have connected with him. He's been struggling. It's been hard. He's trying to not fall into the same mistakes he's made last time, but the average person goes through 9 rehabs. So I like to think that Frank is going to be good for life, but he might have another relapse. But at least he knows how to deal with it now.
I really hope that he does, because to me, listening to him, he almost sounds conscious of the fact that he probably will end up in rehab again, which to me is good in a certain way, but at the same time, it's troubling because it sounds like he wants to make a lot of amends. It sounds like he wants to do the right thing, but knows that he's probably going to relapse.
And I think for him, he's so many demons. I mean, he has no relationship with family. He really only has his sister left and his brother that still believe in him, but they're also skeptical. And he's had a lot of sadness happen in his life.
Now, do you think that sadness is what drives him to make amends for it? Or do you think, what is it, do you think, that drives him to be sober?
You know, I think inside it all, Frank is actually quite ambitious and enjoys being accomplished. And I think he really enjoyed the status of a good job and making money and being in control of his life and, you know, being seen as someone that can deal with, like, life's shitty times better than most people. I think that drives him.
I kind of see it from a point of view of, you know, the same way that he dealt with his business life where he was in control. It almost seems like he wants to be in control of his addiction, but he still wants to have the addiction and access it when he wants to.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, like, an addict is always an addict, right?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like when I hear his story and other stories and hearing the type of stuff they've gone through, I don't know, I feel like I'd be an addict too.
Well,
I do. I feel like I can't pass judgment.
Yeah, well, I mean, it comes down to, what do you want more? Do you want to have the addiction run you, or do you feel like you're making the decision to go through with the addiction? Do you feel like he almost needs the challenge in his life to kick a habit?
No, maybe that's interesting. That is actually something that I've seen consistent with other addicts, is there is an adrenaline of kicking the habit and gaining control.
The Stand Up Speak Up podcast is made in Canada, produced and hosted by Carla Stevens Tolstoy, co-producing, editing, and narration by SafetyNetStudio.com. Copyright 2018. Find us online at StandUpSpeakUpApparel.com. If you have a moment, please leave a rating and review on this platform. Thanks for listening to Stand Up Speak Up.
Thanks for joining me this week. My name is Carla Stevens Tolstoy. My producer has been Dave Wheeler, and we'll talk to you next time.
I'm Andrea Askowitz.
And I'm Allison Langer. And we are the hosts of Writing Class Radio, a podcast, but we are so much more. We have writing classes. So if you are looking for live online classes where you can join a community, write to a prompt, get feedback, and get better, check out all our classes at writingclassradio.com.
And listen to our podcasts wherever you get your podcasts and at writingclassradio.com.